Witches have known of the other worlds for thousands of years. We are as close as a heartbeat. But we cannot touch or see or hear these other worlds. Except in the Northern Lights.
And why there?
Because the charged particles in the Aurora make the matter of this world thin. It is a time when anything can happen.
Anything?
Not that. Not him.
Welcome to Kinfolk Lore, a podcast where we explore fictional worlds that bring people together. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who love to talk about world building and sci-fi and fantasy. We hope that over time, through our shared love of our favorite stories, we all become family on this podcast journey.
For our first season, we're discussing His Dark Materials, the HBO BBC television show. Today, we are going to go through the episode and talk about our reflections on this world. So if you haven't watched His Dark Materials Episode 5, The Lost Boy, please stop, watch it, and come back when you finish.
In addition, we will be discussing adult themes and topics on this podcast. So even if the kids update their Alethiama thingy and call you Lord instead of your government name, it's up to you if they go on this journey. You're in command. This is episode 5.
We start the episode with a voiceover. Witches hear the immortal whispers of those who pass between the worlds. They speak of a child who is destined to bring the end of destiny. If told what she will do, she will fail. But she won't walk alone. There is a boy whose fate is bound with her. Together, they will change everything. During this voiceover, we see a young boy who we learn to be Will Parry walking on the road on a suburban street.
Drizzy!
Sorry.
He's like Drizzy. He looks like Drizzy Drake. He came into I was like, look at Drizzy. He looks like Drizzy and Degrassi. I love it.
Yeah.
There you go.
He does have that Drake from Degrassi look on him. So yeah, I hear you. Lyra the Egyptians and Lee Scoresby, as well as Yorick, are making their way north in search of the missing children. Lee is catching a ride, being carried.
Very relaxed, super duper relaxed. He's like, why walk when you can ride? He's got some sort of bunion issue. He hasn't worked it out with the podiatrist. He's got to rest the buns.
Yeah, I'm like, Yorick is out in front, right? Doing his bit, dragging like supplies. And Lee is like chilling. Even Lyra's walking. I'm like, the little girl's walking.
He did answer the question that I had of where's the balloon when he was walking. I was like, okay, where's the balloon? He's laying on the balloon. That's what's happening. It is now a hammock. No longer a balloon. It's now a hammock. Moving hammock. Being pulled by his friend Yorick and the rest of the Egyptians.
Yep. So, back in our world, Boreal and this creepy dude that he asked to watch Grumman's family are sitting in a car, and they're watching a woman welcome home her son from school. This is Will's mother, Elaine. We learn that despite the difficulties that the family has suffered, no social services are involved with them. So, as Boreal puts it, no one checks in on them. The Egyptians begin to set up their camp as Lord Fa tells Lyra that she was right about Yorick, and ask her to consult the alethiometer so that they know what to expect. Lyra reports back that Balvanger is being protected by Tartar, 60 men with guns, she says. The alethiometer also shows Lyra something else, and when Lord Fa kind of waves her off about the other vision that she sees, Lyra goes to Fodder Quorum to see that she thinks that there's a ghost in a village that is connected to them. She wants to go and find out more about this, and she wants to go alone. And Father Quorum basically tells her, no, can't do it. Got to stay looking for the kids. This is what's most important. Lyra then goes to see Ma Costa, and Ma Costa, you know, asks her a bunch of questions about what she saw. She really listens to her in this section. I really liked it. And in the end, Ma Kasa says, you know, I need to think about this. Lyra tells her that even if she can't trust her, she can trust the alethiometer. And Ma Kasa sort of says, okay, I'm going to think about it and I'll get back to you.
You know, what's great about Ma Kasa is she stays winning. She stays winning for most of the show in the sense that she is the most fully formed adult. Like, she didn't just, like, she wasn't like, you know what, get out of here. We're not going to talk about that. What, are you going to go off on your own? This and that. She legitimately, and it's her son, heard her out. Like, let me hear what you have to say. It's a little far-fetched. I'm not quite sure. But you can tell that bond that she has with Lyra because she's, like, at least willing to hear out what she has to say about this topic.
Yeah, I mean, Lyra starts the conversation by saying, do you trust me? And then telling her, I've seen this thing and I need to go and explore it. And rather than saying, no, get out of here with that, she asks her a bunch of questions to follow up, like, what is it? Why is there a ghost? And Lyra says, I think this could be a clue. And she's honest with her. She doesn't say, you know, I know for sure this is connected to Billy. She's honest with her that she doesn't really know what she's looking for. And she tells her the reason that Lord Fa and Father Coram don't want her to go. Mm-hmm. It's because they're really committed to looking for Billy and Roger and the other children. And Ma Kasa still listens to her and asks her questions about it. And I just thought this was great because a lot of times kids get waved off. The way that Lord Fa was kind of like, yeah, I didn't ask the alethiometer that. Mm-hmm. He was like, Yeah, I don't want to hear anymore.
She's got updates too, by the way, which is crazy. Like, she did a little like OS update. Now she's able to see GPS coordinates.
Love it. Yeah, I had questions about the fact that all of a sudden now the alethiometer is also giving her vision. I mean, I think this was a little clunky, but I also think that it's clunky in the book, so mm-hmm. I can understand why it's not totally explained. Anytime you have a fantasy world, there's always magic that is not fully explained. I've mm-hmm. yet to read a fantasy book or see a fantasy show where they explained all of the magic.
Yep.
So this was a little bit surprising to me that it was an actual vision, you know, like that we saw it as well. I was like, wait, what? it's presented as a vision here, but I think that this is just like the limitations of it's magic. It's like magic. You can't really always explain all the mechanics behind it.
Yep.
What did you think about how Will is introduced through this voiceover?
I actually like it. I know that won't necessarily be a popular commentary, but I actually, and I'll talk about it more later in my, like some of my thoughts about what I liked about the episode, but I actually like that they introduced, I like the first portion of this episode because it departs from the way that the show has kind of been laid out with having voiceover at all. I like that it's Kaiser telling the story because it lets you know that the witches kind of know more than a lot of people about what the importance is of these characters and the people. So they obviously have some knowledge of what the legend is and what the prophecy is. So it goes deeper into that first thing we've been talking about prophecy and destiny. And that line where Kaiser kind of goes into that she will basically, like her destiny is to like undo what it means to have destiny, kind of answers some of the questions I've been having about what that relationship is between the prophecy and destiny, and that she won't have to do it alone. And then they introduce Will, and they, it puts us on a real cool course for the two of them and their characters, and what we're gonna encompass. And I will say this: it also grounds the story, I think, a little bit to have that balance between what's going on in both worlds.
Yeah. So I didn't like it at first because it's not something they've done before. On the first episode, we didn't get a voiceover. We got words on the screen. And so I thought that this was like a weird departure from voice of a story. The story has been told from different points of view as they can do on television. We haven't really had voiceovers. When we have had scenes that have voiceover, it's been because it was edited between two scenes, right? Like, you know, some of Roger's letter writing is a voiceover to Lyra finding the stuff in her mother's office, but that's different from what this was. This was like a very narrative, there's some things we have to tell you. Now, upon second watch and thinking about how they've chosen to lay out this story, I liked it because this is telling us this is the next chapter. We've moved into a different part of the story, and that we have a new character, and they don't want us to see him as a secondary character, that he is just as important to the story as Lyra is. So I kind of liked it in that respect. I also just really like Kaisa, so I, you know.
Yeah, more Kaisa.
More Kaisa, but...
You know what's hard, too, though, is that I think this is part of what they're struggling with the demons, is that the honest... to God truth is that in the first watch, I didn't realize it was Kaisa saying what was being said. I was wondering, whose voice is that? And then when I went back and watched, I was like, oh, okay, it's Kaisa. I get it now. But at first, it was hard for me to even make out where that voice was coming from, which I think could be jarring when you're first watching it.
Yeah, I think that I figured out it was Kaisa pretty, or only because of the way the scene is shot with like Kaisa flying over them. But it was, I wasn't sure. I put a note, like, is this Kaisa's voice? And then when Kaisa spoke later in the episode, I was like, yes, this is for sure the same voice. So I mean, I think it, you know, as we'll go through the episode, we'll see more that the witches really do know more about what's happening. They see the larger picture than the Egyptians or Lyra, or probably even like Asriel and Mrs. Coulter are able to see. The witches are sort of putting together pieces from their historic knowledge of their world and also from what's going on currently. And so it makes sense that Serafina's demon, Kaisa, would know more about what's happening than anybody else in the story. I do have some questions about how he knows about the boy, but yeah, it's fine.
I agree. I hear that.
The reason I had questions about it was because of Serafina's knowledge about the world later. So the assumption is that Kaisa and Serafina have access to the same knowledge.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So we can bring that back later when she speaks to Fata Coram.
Okay. In our world, we see John Parry's son, Will, out here in these streets looking like Jimmy Brooks once again. He is being taunted by another boy and called a freak while he's at school. Back at his house, his mother leaves to run an errand and encounters our boy, Carlo, a.k.a. Charles Latrum, a.k.a. Lord Boreal, on these streets out here looking like new money.
He looks good. He looks good. I was like, hey, Boreal.
Yo, the guy cleaned up nice. He came out and his whole demeanor was different. He had a little glow to him. He was He hits her with
the glow up is extraordinary.
The glow up was extraordinary. It was like, wow. He hit her with the charm, and he even called her Elaine. He tells her, and then he's like, I'm an old friend of your husband, John, and from the military. And she's all like, well, John's dead, right? He died in an expedition in Alaska. To Boreal with the best acting job, like, oh, I didn't know that. Really? Oh, that's so sad. And then he hits her with a smooth move, gives her the card, says if she needs anything, and then pulls away with a little bit of a hand creep. It's a little weird. Little hand creep, like, yo, I'm your guy if you need anything. But she's not falling for it. Back at school, Will is sparring with a classmate in boxing practice, where we discover he has a nice uppercut, but a little bit of a soft chin. Little soft chin, could not take the shot, hit the deck, okay? He's not winning. He's taking L's in this sparring session. His mother arrives, and she's very distressed and acting somewhat erratic. Will's classmate mocks his mother's mental illness, and Will turns and punches him, rightfully so.
Yeah, I was like, beat his ass.
I was ready. I was hoping that he would win this fight, but the classmate goes MMA style and takes him down, and now it's a tackle move. Grappling gets allowed in this boxing sesh. The coach, who seems like a stand-up guy, I like him, he stops the fight and sends Will after his mother. Elaine tries to explain to Will that someone is watching them. After calming her down, Will goes back to get his things, where the coach inquires about his well-being, and he wants to know like if there's anything he can do to help, and Will assures the coach that he can manage without his help. I'm not so sure, but he does tell him this. Back at the Egyptian camp, Lyra tells Ma Costa she is looking for her father in the Northern Lights. Kaiza, who's been guiding the Egyptians, tells her she's wise to look for Azrael up in the Northern Lights, and that the Magisterium believes that her father intends to use what he's finding about dust to create a bridge between the two worlds. Kaiza tells them that even though the bears are holding Azrael at the Magisterium's request, that Yorfor is kind of duplicitous, and he allows Azrael to continue his research against Mrs. Coulter's wishes. Lyra asks Kaiza if he knows what she's seeking in the village that and what the Elite Theometer has shown her and why she would need to go to the village, and he responds no, but that she should trust her instincts, and go. So Ma Kosta seems to co-sign at this moment, saying that she should go ahead and talk to John Fa in the morning.
Yeah, this seemed to be what Ma Kosta needed to hear. Okay, she should go. We can talk a little bit more about how Ma Kosta really does seem to respect and trust demons. Because that comes into the story later. But I actually really, really loved Kaiza's explanation in this, because it was totally necessary that he connected what's happening with Azrael, what's happening with the Magisterium, what's happening with Mrs. Coulter. And then he gives Lyra the confidence to trust her in her own instincts in this moment and say she needs to do this thing that she wants to do, that the alethiometer told her she needs to go to this fishing village and find the ghost. So I really like this end scene. I do want to talk a little bit about Will and his punk classmate, and how I was like, beat that ass, ugh. Will. Beat him. I have no tolerance for people who make fun of mental illness. I just don't have it. This kid is so disgusting. I was... violence is not right, but this kid deserved it. I wish Will would have knocked him out right there and then.
I just, you know, I'm with you 110%. I just feel like Will, I guess is why he's in there sparring in the gym, because not very good at the boxing. Not very good. I just thought, man, this is more motivation. And maybe it's because he's so angry. Maybe he's like, you know, blinded by the anger, and that's part of it. But it was whack. That guy's whack. The way that he's kind of like, the way that all those kids are teasing him because of his mom, and I think part of it, which is very clear by what the coach says, is when, you know, I don't want people to think, and then the coach stops him. Is like, your mom needs you to not care about what people think. Your mom needs you to show up and be there for her, which is what made me really see the coach's character, why I said he seems like a stand-up guy, is he's like, dude, like, who cares what they think? Like, go take care of your mom. And even sending him right away to go take care of his mom as like a way of like a nod to like, man, I realize there's something going on and that she needs help. Was really stand up. And so, yeah, that guy's a punk. We're happy that he gets a little something.
Yeah, I also think it was great that the coach thought that, you know, understood that Will should go after his mom. Because she is acting neurotic here, but she's not actually, everything she's saying is true. Like, she's not, this is not made up people, like, Boreal and this other guy who she clearly has noted watching her before are there, and she's scared by this. This is terrifying. And it makes me wonder if this has happened before, where people have come to check in on Will's mother and ask questions about her husband. And just nobody's been believing her this whole time. The jump, I'm wondering if this is a woman who is actually mentally ill and paranoid, or if she actually, if this is, you know, she has a reason to be acting paranoid, because it's clear in this scene and throughout the rest of the episode that her paranoia is totally justified, but nobody seems to really believe her. Will doesn't even believe her.
Yeah, 100%. And that alone can be a frustrating and isolating place, which could lead to what precedes people. Leaves people's perceptions about her being mentally ill is that she's telling the truth, but because nobody in our world understands that there are other worlds and parallel universes that she's and dangers that people don't understand, because she has some understanding of it. For her to say, you in one of the other upcoming scenes, you're going to pick up his mantle, your father's work was not done. she has some knowledge of what he was doing by reading those letters or whatever it was he was communicating to her in their own personal communication. And that kind of hits home to like know, like, hey, she's aware of some things that is hard for our world to wrap their mind around. And I think that's one of the things that when you shout this out about you don't have tolerance for people making fun of people with mental illness, it's also fair to note that a lot of times I've heard Dave Chappelle say it's calling people crazy. It's just minimizing people's thought process and what they're like doing. And the word itself is kind of demeaning. And all of those things that guy was doing is like, you don't understand it. So now you're minimizing somebody else. And that's what we kind of see as reflections back to what Will is responding to of saying, I don't want to like deal with what they're saying about my mom. And that's why I thought the coach's commentary about who cares, take care of your mom, take care of yourself, what can I do to help, was super powerful. And much like Ma Costa is with Lyra.
Yeah, definitely. So back at the Egyptian camp, Father Coram is walking by himself and Serafina Pekala appears.
Yes!
My girl!
I know you were waiting for that.
I love this character so much. So he notes that she looks basically the same as mm-hmm. when he left her many years ago. And she mm-hmm. tells him that he doesn't look very different to her. She's been alive for 300 years. And so, you know, what's 40 or 50 years? No big deal.
No big deal.
Father Coram essentially begs Serafina for help. He explains that he's duty-bound to try to find the children who have been taken, even if it means that the Egyptians are not going to win. Serafina tells him that Azrael is right to be looking for other worlds and wanting to explore them. She says that the witches have known for years and years and years that there are other worlds and that the Northern Light is where the matter between worlds is very thin. And in the Aurora, anything can happen. At the end of this really moving exchange, they share a kiss.
Yeah, Father Coram, you still got it. Still got it.
You know, she said he doesn't look much different. And Lord Fa told him he was never much to look at to begin with. So, you know, he's got that charm. Clearly, there's something else that she's interested in.
Yeah, she is not shallow. She was like, you think I can't see the man underneath a couple of years? She was like hitting him with, she's got game. I respect it.
Serafina was like, she was, yeah, this was a great scene. I loved her.
Yeah.
So she basically says she's going to leave and consult with her sister witches, but that Kaiza is going to lead them to the missing children. As she flies away, Father Coram really breaks down, and I never want to see this actor cry again. I'm really good on that. This was a lot.
John Cosmo is, you know, yes, he's Father Coram, and we have tried not to think about it on this show, but you know, he is also Lord Mormont in our hearts.
Yes, so he will always be Lord Mormont.
Always be. So to see him breaking down like two episodes in a row, like, man, let's comfort this guy. Let's take care of him. Father Coram. We got to hold him down.
And he's such a good character in this, too. He's great. He's a great actor. He makes every scene that he's in really powerful. I love this guy. So in the next scene, Lyra gets Lord Fa's permission to go to the village and seek this ghost. I really like their exchange here because he's like, you call me Lord Fa when you want something and John Fa when you don't. And then she responds by calling him Lord Fa again. So he tells Yorick to take Lyra where she wishes to go and commands Lyra to return back to the camp before nightfall the following day. And it seems like for the first time, Lyra is actually like, yes, I'm going to follow your directions.
Yo, when he gets big, like, you know, I am the Northern King. When he goes into that role, he's like, I am commanding you now, Lyra. And she's like, yes, you are. And you can, his whole voice changes, his demeanor. I want you back in camp by tomorrow morning. I'm like, yes. I love him when he gets big on these people. It's one of my favorite attributes.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I was expecting Lyra to have her kind of like whimsical look. And she was like, no, I will be back by curfew, sir.
She was too. You saw she got back. She was not messing around.
She was not messing with her curfew. So
no.
The next scene is Yorick and Lyra set off and mm-hmm. Lee bids them farewell. And Yorick promises Lee that he will definitely bring Lyra back. Next scene is this beautiful scene. I mean, just gorgeous.
Roll that beautiful bear footage.
It's just, it is just stunning what they can do. I mean, it was beautiful. Yorick and Lyra riding through the snowy terrain. It was just, I loved it. It was really, really pretty.
It was awesome.
And also it just shows you how far they're going because there's nothing in front of them. There's nothing behind them. And Yorick is actually able to go quite fast. Mm-hmm. Which was cool to see too. My major question for this scene is, where is Pan?
Not sure. Don't know. He's, you know, I was so distracted by the open ice and Yorick running at the pace that he was, and I just I didn't notice it until my second watch that Pan was not around. But it's notable. It's notable that he's not there.
Noticed it right away.
Yeah.
Like I immediately was like, "This is beautiful. Where's my boy Pan now?" Pan's yeah, kinda, not there. I don't. It's very. I find it very strange. I have to wonder if like something like a scene got cut where Pan turned into a mouse or something and got into her bag. But like I thought it was weird.
I mean, from the source material, he definitely is like in her pocket, and we know like from what when I read it. But it makes you wonder. It does make you wonder if Lyra is like Jon Snow's long lost cousin. You know. Out here riding bears, forgetting about her demon, much like he forgot about ghosts. You know what I mean? Like he was riding dragons, forgot about ghosts. You know, we, you know, left them behind. It's cool. We see how it is.
Yeah, yeah. So it was. I had trouble with this. So back in our world, Will and his mother are sharing dinner. Elaine tells Will how much like his father he is, and she says that Will's father always found a way to protect the vulnerable, and that Will mm-hmm. is going to take up his mantle. This is the scene that you were referring to earlier. Mm-hmm. She says something that really stayed with me in this scene, where she says this world is broken, mm-hmm. and it takes extraordinary people to fix it. And then after she says this, she kind of notices that something's different about the apartment, and she begins to panic. She goes into her closet and retrieves a packet of letters from Will's father that she's hidden. She refuses to show the letters to Will, saying that she has to keep him safe and that he isn't ready. Hmm.
Really, really, really good stuff. I mean, that scene, let's start with that scene. That scene to me was really, really strong. In the sense that you get a sense of how Will cares for his mother. You also get a sense of how she cares for him. And then there's like a little hint that she knows more. Like we were talking about earlier, she knows a little bit more than what other people know. Even if they're willing to dismiss her and act like she doesn't, she has understanding that other people do not. And she has awareness, like to look around and be like, something's happened in this house. I don't think she's wrong. I don't think I put it behind this guy, Boreal, and his minion getting into the house while she was away and looking around for things. Why wouldn't they?
I absolutely think they were in the house. And yeah. Also, I know people. I'm not one of these people. My life is very much organized chaos. But like, I know people who can't actually tell if something's been moved very slightly, even though no one else can tell. Like they could tell if you put the milk container back in the fridge differently. I think that's what she's seeing. I mean, she's home all the time, right? Like Will, she obviously does not work. Will goes to school, but she's home most of the day. My guess is that she knows where every single thing in that apartment is, or I think it's a house actually, everything in the house is. And so when she's looking around and she's like, there's marks on the carpet and someone's moved things, I totally believe her that Boreal and his minion went in there while she was out getting eggs, and then she went over to see Will at school. So I think that totally they were in her house.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And let's talk about another moving interaction in this segment is the one between Serafina Pecola and Fata Coram.
Oh man. This conversation, woo!
Yeah.
Lots happening here. Yeah. Can we just note that Fata Coram came out really strong in the beginning? Was like, I didn't want to see you.
Super tough in the beginning, got super thirsty within 30 seconds. He was like, I had never stopped thinking about you or him or our son. It was like, yo, come on, Father Quorum, let's hold it together a little bit stronger. You can't come on that tough and then be like a puddle at the end. It's funny.
Yeah, he comes on really strong in the beginning, like, this isn't about us, this is about business. And yeah. I'm like, aren't you about to ask her for a favor?
Yeah. It was wild. And one of my funniest parts about that is he was trying to be super, he was throwing shade at Asriel, like, Asriel stands on no high ground, you know, he's talking about different worlds. And she's like, he's right to talk about different worlds. He's like, he is? You know what I mean? Like, immediately, he's, really? Oh, crap. I thought he was out here looking crazy. You know what I mean? Like, that's it. Like,
why did he bring up Asriel to begin with? I was like, Is there something between Seraphina and Asriel? Why is Asriel? He definitely brought up Asriel like Asriel was with her ex.
you know, like Ms. Coulter said, there were so many. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean,
that's
why I was like, maybe Mrs. Coulter was onto something here.
Yeah, it's wild. It's super, super. I mean, it's obvious that that he was trying to throw shade at Asriel. He feels a little way, like I feel a little way about Asriel. Me and Father Quorum, we hang out and talk about Asriel. But no, I thought it was really, really strong. It gave you context to what their relationship was, deeper than what it's been hinted at. And it shows you that there's still a deep, you know, all the jokes aside, a deep amount of love that they still share. And, you know, she still harbors some resentment. She even hits him with the whole commentary when he's talking about the loss of, you know, how he'll you know, he's duty bound to fight for to get these children. And she's like, well, I see you found your fight since we last saw each other, referencing the fact that he was unwilling to fight like she was for their son. And he, you know, corrects her and says, listen, our son was ill. These children have been kidnapped. There's a difference. And so there's some different philosophical things, but all of those things aside, you can tell that these two people deeply love each other and have never stopped loving each other. And even with those differences, are willing to still put them aside to help each other.
Yeah. Yeah. This conversation was super loaded. I loved it. It was great. And it gave us some information we didn't have before, where she, again, like Kaiza earlier, made connections between Asriel, the Magisterium. She's laying out why the Northern Lights are important, why what Asriel is doing is important, and just how much knowledge about it the witches have previously. I guess I wanted, and I'm, maybe this will be explained later, but I just wanted to know how much the witches know about the other worlds. Like, do they know that there are, like, do they know what worlds there are, how many there are? I assume that Seraphina and Kaiza have access to the same information. Kaiza knows about Will. Do they understand how it's connected, or is this just all whispers that they've heard? You know, Kaiza in the beginning said that the witches hear whispers. So is it just that they have access to limited information and then they have to sort of put it together the same way that Lyra puts together what the alethiometer shows her? Or do they have more, do they really understand what's going on here, but they're unable to access it? I mean, she said, you know, we cannot hear the other world, we cannot touch it. But they know that they're there.
Mm-hmm. I think like the way I took it, and you tell me what you think, is that Kaiza and Seraphina know of the other world and they know of the prophecy. They didn't necessarily know until they ran into Lyra that she was the girl who was prophesized about, and now they're starting to see, and Kaiza's like, yeah, she should trust the alethiometer because she's most likely the one. This is how it's kind of spreading. But they may not know who Will is, but they know about the other portion of the prophecy. So they haven't seen him yet. He hasn't revealed himself to them yet. So maybe they hear about what's happening, but don't exactly know that Will exists yet or where he exists.
Yeah, that's a good explanation.
Yeah. It's not clear. They have not made it clear. We'll say that, though. That's for sure.
But last episode, I sort of lamented that I didn't feel that the show was making the connection between this plot about the children and the journey that Boreal mm-hmm. and Asriel are on. And I feel mm-hmm. that this episode in Expedition did that. Like, they have used these voiceovers, these conversations with the, you know, the witches or their representatives, and provided more context to the larger story and made that connection between what Boreal is doing and Lyra. It's still not clear that the children are necessarily connected, but at least we have the we understand that Boreal's track and Lyra's track at some point will converge, and Will is that thing that puts them together.
Yep, I agree. So moving on to the next portion of this episode, Lyra cuddles up next to Yurik in a cave where they stopped for a little bit of a bite to eat. I loved it. She's breaking up her hard-boiled eggs. He's eating a carcass. It's good times for all.
Also, he's just kind of like, I hope you bought something with you because I'm not planning on sharing.
Yeah. No, he definitely was not handing her over some of the raw meat, which is
yeah,
probably good.
He wasn't, there was no fire. He wasn't about to be like, here, some of this deer is for you. No, he was like, I got my food.
I got my food. And I love it. I love it, that little moment, and it will keep going with the summary, but I love that little moment where she, like, you know, kind of gets closer to him, and he's like, looks at her like, yo, and she's like, I meant no disrespect. I'm just super cold. And it shows this bond that they're starting to develop, which is really, really cool. And that continues when she asks if he ever gets lonely without a demon. And he says that bears are designed to be solitary. And Lyra responds by saying that there are thousands of Svalbard bears and that her father is being held by them. Yorick says that he was a Svalbard bear and a prince who violated the rules and was sent away. He tells Lyra that he killed another bear and that bears should not kill bears. He said he was stripped of all rank and his title rightfully, and that if her father is imprisoned by the Svalbard bears, he will not escape. In the next scene, Will looks for his mother and finds her bedroom empty. In her absence, he finds the letters, and Elaine returns to see him with the letters and tells him that he can read the letters if he wants to, because he might need them soon. Lyra and Yurik arrive in the village that she saw in her vision. Yurik and Pan both sense something is wrong immediately in the village. The village is abandoned, and Yurik seems to sense that whatever she is looking for is in the boathouse. Lyra is struggling with her fear. She repeats over and over again, "When I am frightened, I shall master my fear." Pan tells her to turn back.
He's really not okay. Like, no. Pan is like, so I think we need to go. Like, I don't know. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, he's done. Even Yurik asks her, do you know what you're doing? To which Lyra shows a little bit of truthfulness, because normally she'd put on airs, and she's like, no, I don't. And he's like, okay. So they're building that respect too, which is pretty, pretty crazy. In the cottage, Lyra finds Billy Costa, who is clearly suffering and unable to move on his own. He has no demon. Lyra and Pan decide that they're going to take Billy back to his mother.
Billy.
Yeah. Yeah.
He looks so bad. I mean, God, Billy looks so bad. His head is shaven. He looks like he's just been through this horrible ordeal. And Pan is the one who notes immediately that Radder is missing.
Yeah.
Where's like Radder? Pan is like, where's his demon? Where's Radder? What's going on? This is really uncomfortable. And both Pan and Lyra are beginning to sense something is really wrong with Billy, and his aura makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah. It is a tough sequence. And so they return to the Egyptian camp, where Ma Costa recognizes Billy right away and asks also, where is Radder? Lyra tells Lee that Billy was without his demon, like a ghost, and that the Alethiometer was right when it was talking about a ghost in the town. Lee says that the children's demons are being cut away for the purpose of control. He's quoted as saying, if you can remove someone's soul, you can do anything. Tony and Ma Costa are comforting Billy, who's still gravely unwell. Ma Costa sings to him and tells him that he can go to Radder, that they will be all right, and that he's okay for him to leave, and Billy passes away. Back in our world, Elaine is looking up for the evening when she notices the front door is open. She sees Boreal's minion sitting in the car and watching the house.
This was a tough sequence. I just...
Yeah.
Billy... can I just say that the acting between this family, the Costa family, was just stunning. Tony, yeah, I think, has one line in the scene where Ma Costa is comforting Billy. And it's basically when she says... you can go, and Tony says no. But the devastation on Tony's face, I mean, he is just, it is, I was a mess.
Yeah.
I was a mess, and frankly, I was not expecting this, because in the books, this is a different character this happens to. I was really, really not expecting it to be Billy.
I had to really dig back in my memory. And I did a little bit of research too, and found out that in the Golden Compass that it is Billy, the movie, right? But in the book, it's totally not. And that kind of threw me off. And I was not expecting it to be Billy. I understand how it moves the story forward and how it raises the stakes for the characters and all of those things, but I wanted Billy to get the ending that for him that was in the books, and where he's reunited with his family in much, much happier circumstances. But alas, we lose our friend Billy on this road.
Yeah, I will say that this does raise, while this was wildly effective with an emotional reaction, and it certainly will move the story along, it does raise some of the limitations that the story has, in that they never really explain the connection with the demons in the way that the book does. Because when this happens in the book, the character, we don't have as much of a emotional connection to the character this happens to. Mm-hmm. But what's stunning about this scene is that you're seeing a child with no demon, with no soul, mm-hmm, who is holding on to a fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the child is seeking that connection and it feels so lost without it. And so this was just, while I think this was effective, and I'm actually really glad the fish was, like, that would have pushed me over the edge.
Yeah.
This scene is effective for a different reason. It works because we are emotionally connected to Billy and Tony and Ma Costa, and also Billy's relationship with Roger, right? So now we have to ask, well, where's Roger? But this scene should be devastating in its own right because we're seeing a person with no soul.
Yeah, and it's one of the places where, you know, we've talked offline and we've hinted at some on the show of the fact that they haven't done the work to deal with the depth of how important the demons are. They've, you know, they've put up, you know, titles on the screen and they've shown certain things. But one of the parts about when Adele was killed that you can kind of look at and say, well, why was it so shocking when Boreal grabs her butterfly demon? And for people who've read the source material, you know that to touch someone's demon in this world is totally sacrilegious and, like, against all kinds of, like, social norms. And in fact, goes beyond that. It's like defiling the person in general. And so to have a situation where they find Billy and his demon has been cut away has significant weight to the story. And that's one of the places where I think they have to go deeper if we're going to continue down this road of deepening the connection between the humans and the demons and what that really means.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this part will do a lot for that, right? Mm-hmm. I think that in a way they've elected to do the show don't tell part for the demons, mm-hmm, but I just don't know if they've shown enough. And I think some of it does need to be told because, mm-hmm, it's just not, we're seeing what happens to a person when their demon is cut away from them, when they're severed, but the consequences, this should have been impactful because we should have known already how consequential that would be. You know, mm-hmm, the way the show has kind of presented demons up to this point is, yeah, they've told us they're part of, you know, a demon is your soul, is a representation of your soul. But the characters kind of treat their demons like pets.
Yep. 100%.
So I felt this scene deeply. I just wondered if in the storytelling they could have done a better job of making us upset about this because someone's soul has been removed rather than because we're seeing a beloved character die.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, and I think, you know, it goes to the fact that one of the reasons why that's true also is we don't spend a lot of time with Radder. Like, and not that we spend a lot of time with Billy, but even when Billy and Roger were in captivity, we saw, you know, Roger's demon more than we saw Billy's demon. And so there's some things there, but you know, what it does do in this scene, there's a couple of things that happen, is it does answer some questions that Lord Fa and we as an audience raised earlier. Well, what are they doing to these children? What is it that he means when he's talking about the child cutters, when Yorick is saying, and now it's clear that what they're doing is they're cutting away these children's demons, and they're doing it so that they can control them. Because if you can get rid of, as Lee Scoresby says, someone's soul, you can do anything with them. If they have no soul and no conscience, then you can pour whatever you want into that if they're able to stay alive.
Yeah. And also, can I just note that these people are monsters? Like, who does this to a child and then just leaves them? Like, it was a lot to see Billy all by himself, having no idea how long he's been there. And to think that a night was wasted, right? Like, Lyra sees this vision in the daylight, has a whole night happens that Billy was alone, suffering this way, and then she finds him the following night, which what a devastating scene.
Yeah, and it's like followed up, right? It's followed up, and great foreshadowing by the writers and everything else, but it's followed up. This scene is before we get to the scene, it's that conversation with Yorick and Lyra about, do you ever feel lonely without your demon? And so you're talking about the whole day and night has gone by. And not only is he, you know, has his demon been cut away, but he's there by himself alone. And I mean, you see the cut on his head, which is like meaning they did more than just cut away the demon. They tried other things as well through the experiments. It's tough to see Billy in that state, for sure.
Yeah, and obviously what's happened to him is traumatic, and there's no one there with him to explain it. There's no one there with him to tell him it's okay. I mean, it was terrible. I can't imagine any child going through this by themselves in this type of isolation. And it just shows you the savagery of the people who are doing this, that they would leave him alone.
Yep. I agree, man. So I guess we can move on.
Yeah. It's tough to move on, but yeah. the episode does continue. So back in our world, Boreal's meeting with his original minion, Thomas, the hacker. And Thomas tells Boreal that he found a money trail between an account that Parry set up before he left to go to Alaska and Will's mother's account. So she gets a monthly stipend. It's just enough to live on. It's not like thousands and thousands of pounds. It's just like enough to get by. And Thomas asserts that Grumman must have known that he wouldn't be coming back for a long time if he set up the account like this. He posits that before going on his expedition to Alaska, he must have known about the window between worlds. The next morning, we're back with the Egyptians in the camp, and Lee tells Lyra that Billy has passed away, and she asks if she can see him. She's taken to his funeral pyre to say goodbye, and Lord Fa turns to Ma Costa and says that they know what they have to do. They have to fight, because now that they know what's happened with their children. Ma Costa has this great line, feeling exactly what I would have felt. And she says, we have to kill. The Egyptians watch as Billy's body is burned, and Lord Fa leads them in this beautiful hymn. The lyrics are very haunting. Some of them are, dear son, your soul never leaves. You are God's son. And this repeats over and over again. And everyone is mourning. All of the people, all of the demons. It's a really moving scene. And at this point, we should take a moment and pour one out.
Pour one out. for the cutest kid ever, Billy Costa.
Just so cute. Billy, we're going to miss you.
What a loss. What a loss. Well, you will be missed, Billy. You will be missed. You and Ratter.
Oh, yeah. I already forgot about poor Ratter. Okay. Well, back in our world, Will is having a bad dream while his mother looks in the mirror in the other room. I hope this dream comes up again because I honestly didn't understand what we were supposed to see in this very short scene. Mm-hmm. It's nightfall at the Egyptian camp, and there are people who scale the walls, break into the camp, and attack. I'm assuming that these are Tartars. And they kill several people who are keeping watch. Pan wakes up Lyra, says that he hears something, and she goes outside to investigate. And I need to take a moment to talk about how ridiculous it is that Pan is like, hey, I hear something, wake up. I'm just going to stay as a tiny ferret, though. I'm not going to turn into anything that can protect us. I'm just going to be a ferret.
Has the worst. This comes up again later on, like moments, minutes later. He turns into the worst stuff. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand what Pan is doing in these moments. Oh my gosh.
I think in like the first or second episode, you said Pan is shook. Pan is just always shook. Like, what always. Pan is just always shook. Like, Pan, first of all, you're not going to help her fight. So, like, just don't wake her up. Like, try to just tell her to stay inside. Like, what are you doing? Wake up, Lyra. I hear something. Let's go investigate. I'm just going to stay as a rodent.
Oh, my gosh.
I was like, Pan, come on. Like, turn into a fox. Turn into, like, at least a cat. Can we get something bigger than a rodent?
And the poor bastard who has a squirrel demon who they have standing watch. Like, that's the wrong guy to have standing watch. He has a squirrel demon. Like, what is he going to do? Like, is he that nice with his sword or gun or whatever he's using? Like, he's not that. He has a squirrel. Like, that's a bad choice, Lord Fox.
Yeah, can we talk about how the Magisterium is just better at picking, like, enforcers? Their 100%. Cops have dogs as demons.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Egyptians are like, let's use this guy with a squirrel.
So we're in the north. We know that there's probably Tartars out there. We know we're going towards the Magisterium who has dogs. Nobody knows that the Tartars have wolf demons, like, at all? And they leave the squirrel demon, the guy with the squirrel. He's going to chuck acorns at all the wolves. It's happening. Cannot deal. I just don't know what we're thinking here with this choice.
Oh gosh, I had so much trouble with this. Like, I was like, Pan. I was yelling at the television, like, Pan, change, Pan, change.
Change. Yeah. Into anything. All right. Well, you know, he did it. He does not.
So of course, Lyra gets captured again because Pan and her are just like not fighters. Like,
reckless.
If York's not there, Lyra's lost. Like, this is
pedestrian.
She really can't protect herself, which is, she's a little girl, so I get it, but like, I expected more from Pan. Lyra's taken to a lab of some kind. They're speaking a different language, which according to the captions on my television is Finnish. Mm-hmm. There's a woman who I think is a doctor, and she's inquiring about Lyra's age, who she is. Lyra lies about her name. And the doctor is a little bit concerned about whether or not Pan has settled. She asks about, oh, you have a ferret demon. And then Pan is like, I'm going to change into a butterfly.
Butterflies in the sky. I can go twice as high. I mean, what was he thinking? I don't know what he was thinking. Like, why did he turn into a butterfly in that
moment? I think that, actually, this may be a moth, but I think that, like, Pan just changes into a butterfly or a moth when he's nervous. Like, this is one of his strategies.
Because it worked out so well for Adele. Like, it just was like, it worked out great to have the butterfly going on. It just worked out. I mean, he doesn't know how it worked out for Adele, but still, it's tough.
Yeah. So the doctor tells the nurse that Lyra is category A. I'm assuming we will find out next episode what that means. I think it has to do with the fact that Lyra is getting older and she's, you know, at some point her demon is going to settle. The nurse tells Lyra to undress so they can make sure she's healthy. She's giving a uniform, which is the exact same uniform that Billy was wearing when she found him, which Pan notes right away. And Lyra realizes that they are in Bullvanger. This is the station where the children have been taken. Yeah. And that's the end of the episode.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. This is, again, and you know what? I want to start off by saying I'm a big fan of the show. We both are. I actually like this episode quite a bit. I really do. And that being said, we wouldn't be true fans and also just doing what we're setting out to do if not fully talking about the parts that we like about the story, the parts that we question about the story, and the parts that we think, man, we could see more of, or and that's why we have this segment that we're about to go into. But one of the things that is really jumps out is this, that we have to ask the question, what is category A? Because they haven't gone deep enough in that, hey, at a certain point, they've said it a couple of times, her demon's going to stop changing. So now you're relying on the audience to go back 3 episodes and say, oh yeah, remember when then her and Fata Quorum were talking about, I don't want my demon to change, then that. So now they're saying, oh, maybe she's category A, because if her demon's, if she hits puberty while she's here, she's older, then her demon will stop changing and be whatever it is. And Lord, the way that Pan's discretion about changing into things is, please don't stop yet. Just don't. Please.
Yeah, Pan is not ready to settle. Yeah, they're not ready. This is not physically ready. It's not a great look.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm okay with the category A thing just because I think it will be explained. I mean, I think it's okay that we have to kind of put together the pieces here. Mm-hmm. I do have an issue with how Lyra is captured.
Yeah.
This is not at all what happens in the books, and it does definitely seem like the Tartars were there just to get Lyra, and that's not true.
Well, yeah, I guess I can start off there. So when we're in this segment about what we like, what we question, and what we see more of, I normally start off with what I like, but I'll start there. That's what I question in this episode, is I question the change from the source material of how Lyra ends up at Bullvanger. Because in the original text, it's an ambush by the Tartars that resulted in a huge battle between the Tartars, the Egyptians, Yorick, Lee are fighting on the side of the Egyptians. And it looks like they grab Lyra in the midst of that, but that their intention is just to raid the Egyptians. And I really wasn't sure why they got away from that, because it adds to the tension and the concern and the desperation that Lyra has when she ends up at Bullvanger, because she's questioning, did Yorick survive this battle? Did Fata Quorum live? Did John Fa live? She has all these questions about, is Lee Scoresby okay? And she is concerned that she's not going to get out of here. She doesn't know where she is and whether the people who she's grown so close to actually have been wiped out or not. And I think that it would have given us an opportunity to see the Egyptians fight, to kind of sense how good they are as warriors before we get into any sort of conflict that they're going to have with the Magisterium. I think this is a missed opportunity for sure, and I question why they did that.
Yeah, I also had questions in this scene, like, where's Kaiza?
Yeah.
You know, like, my thought was, okay, so Tony, Ma Costa, Lord Fa all have bird demons. So I was like, wouldn't you put people with bird demons on watch, because they have the overhead?
Nope. The guy, like, with the squirrel.
Lee even says in the first scene of this episode that the birds can see better than he would be able to in a air balloon. And so I had now, okay, so all those people with the bird demons are sleeping. This is nighttime. Ma Costa and Tony have obviously had a horrible day. Mm-hmm. So I get that. But I'm like, is Kaiza not keeping watch overhead? Like, this felt like, how did this happen? There's so many Tartars. And how did the Egyptians get so caught off guard by this? It seemed, I just imagine that this would happen. Maybe they'd get a couple of kills in, and then there would be all bedlam would break out.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That's not really what was presented on screen. What was presented was, like, this was a sneak attack, and they captured Lyra, and then they left. which cannot be what happened, right? Like, there has to be more that we didn't see, but it just seemed like they were after Lyra. Yeah. Nobody else is awake in this camp. So it seems, to me, I read this, you know, that Mrs. Coulter sent these guys after her, but I don't, that doesn't make sense.
No, and it's not, and it's not to, you know, and we know from like reading the source material,
and also from the preview, it's clear Mrs. Coulter, in the preview you can tell Mrs. Coulter doesn't realize Lyra's there.
No, of course not. No, and that, and at all. Like, so my thought on that is like, there's some of the things that I was thinking just from like how cool it would have been to see is like in that scene, right? And this is similar, and we didn't go over it. This is similar to like the scene with the spy flies, because the scene with the spy flies, and I understand there's budgetary considerations, you know, Pan turns into all kinds of stuff and there's a whole battle and like the whole thing to kind of obtain the spy, get the spy fly. But in this scene, okay, let's say you skip that. In this scene, one of the things that would have been great to see is there's like lack of visibility in the area when the fight happens, and Lyra can't figure out whether she sees John Fa fighting, but she can't figure out whether he's alive. She sees Yurik like run out into like the darkness of the snow and hears like screaming out in the darkness, similar to like what we saw many times in like the bear scene in Game of Thrones when they travel beyond the wall, or any of those other things where like, you know, when like you heard all the screaming when they went out into in Game of Thrones, anyway, when they went out from Winterfell in the battle in the Long Night episode. That would have been great to see Yurik run out into the darkness and hear a bunch of Tartars just screaming because he's wrecking them, and then come back and not be able to see whether he's okay, whether they're okay. It would have answered it would have showed a lot about why Lyra's going to be more nervous or anxious in Ballvanger than just to be captured. Because if she knows they're coming for her anyway, and no harm has come to them, why would she be concerned?
Yeah. I mean, I think that this episode just was already packed narratively. And the purpose of this episode was to do two things. One was to really introduce Will's character, and we should talk more about their decision to introduce Will at this point in the story. Because we had some like offline conversations about that several episodes ago. Like, were they gonna do this? And then the other thing was to really show what's happening to the children. They're definitely moving into the next phase of the story, and I appreciate that. And I get why, in addition to that, they didn't want to have a big battle scene in this episode. But I think they just could have ended the episode when Billy died. And then we have the battle next episode. Like, that would have been an awesome opening scene. Like, they didn't need to do this, to consolidate what is a pretty big turning point in the book into what seems like a nighttime raid with precision to get Lyra. This was chaos in the book.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is approach it similarly to how, which we give them a lot of flack, right? How Benioff and Weiss approached Blackwater. There was a whole episode of preparation of knowing that they were going to be attacked. And then you get Blackwater, and like, it's like, oh, okay, that actually makes sense. You just dedicate it to the battle, to what happens. Let us see like why we should be concerned for Lyra and getting captured, and let us feel the same anxiety. Like when in the books, when I'm reading them, like honestly, and Lyra is taken, and I don't know whether John Fa's alive or whether they're really going to make it there until later on. You know what I mean? So anyway, I agree. We should get into like what Will, introducing Will, which is a big, big thing of this episode, one of the biggest rocks. And I actually sat with this a bunch, and I know there's a lot of opinions out there. That there was one opinion I read in Vulture that was talking about the fact that introducing Will so early takes away the tension that you feel in the second book when he's introduced and you have no idea why you're even following this character at all. But what I do, I think it's difficult to pull that off on a TV show. And I actually like that they've introduced Will, and they've introduced the parallels of the stories that Will and Lyra have. And it's strictly, you know, as a show watcher, there had to feel like in moments that there were tangents that they were going on with Boreal going over to this other world. And Andrea and I spoke during the week about how enjoyable that feeling of like having that anxiety was in the beginning when you don't understand who a character is in the beginning of a book in The Subtle Knife. But it's also hard to introduce a character in a second season that you haven't introduced in the first season. So I give the show a pass for that. So I like the way Will has been introduced because what it does is settles and it kind of grounds the story of why Boreal keeps going over into this other world, of the importance of Grumman, a.k.a. John Parry. And it also puts us on this, like, for me, being a Game of Thrones guy, it puts me in this headspace of, like, John and Dany and their separate stories and how they end up coming together at a certain point in the story. And let's just hope that this one doesn't end murdery. A little less murdery. You know what I mean? Let's just hope, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had to... I thought about this a lot, too, about introducing Will. We had said... I think when you and I were debriefing about episode 2 and how they went to the other worlds and how fast the story seemed to be moving, I think I was like, it's possible we'll see Will this season. Mm-hmm. And that seemed so crazy. Like when I said it privately because it just seemed crazy. Mm-hmm. Because this story has spent so much time developing the characters, I do think it would be difficult to introduce a new character in the first episode of season 2.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that the character work here has been really strong. And because they're adding depth to characters who didn't necessarily have it in the book or didn't have it this early in the book, that we learned more about these characters later on which would have been like season 2, season 3 of the show. I think that it would be tough to then have the audience suddenly care about this other kid who's in an entirely different world. And I also think that Boreal, who has emerged as being one of the more interesting characters in this season, who is really not that super interesting in the first book, mm-hmm. Will has to come into the story in order for Boreal to be interested. Like otherwise, it just seems like Boreal is like obsessed with this other guy who is doing, as far as we know, is doing exactly what Boreal can do, which is walking between worlds. Yeah. So I think that in order to have Boreal's journey seem important, Will has to come into the story. Like, there's no way to avoid it. Because Will's story is important to Lyra's. And that's how this whole thing... That's how this whole thing's going to resolve. So I think that it's a bold choice. A lot of their choices have been bold. They've spoiled the other books for people. Mm-hmm. But I... like it so far. We'll have to see where it goes. And I also do wonder if in introducing some of the stuff from the other books, if that's why we're missing out on some of these pivotal moments in the show, like showing us how the Tartars attacked the Egyptian camp, explaining the demons more. Like, I think that, you know, anytime you add material or content, you lose things as well. Every episode can't be 2.5 hours. So we'll see. I like what they've done, but we'll have to watch and see how they land it. There's only, I think, 3 episodes left. So
yeah, 3 episodes of this season. They've already begun, you know, the second season shooting. So that's good. That's encouraging, meaning that we'll get some consistency. And you know, I guess what I want to see more of is I just want to see them, you know, like fill in the blanks for people who aren't book readers. Like, it's really easy for us to follow the story because we've read the books and I've read them recently. So I'm like, oh, okay, I get why that would happen. And I understood, you know, some other things. And I think if you're a show watcher, you don't mind that it's Billy Costa. Like, it actually adds to the tension that you're feeling just watching the show. So it's a strong choice. But what I would like is to see things like, why are the Egyptian warriors feeling confident enough that they'll go into this battle? Like, what makes them strong? They're a bunch of guys who look like they walked out of an H&M after a shopping spree. And they don't look like very strong young people. And a lot of them are like, you know, not older, but, you know, they're not like, they don't look like, you know, it's not like warriors walking and marching into the north. And so what, let's see some of their fighting skills. Let's see some of the things that they do. We get a little hint with Ma Costa with like the fire at the stove. And it'd be interesting to see some of that. It'd also be interesting for them to just go a little bit deeper with connecting humans to demons so that we can really feel the pain of what's happening for people with what's happening with these kids and what the overall plot is that the Magisterium has.
Yeah. The Magisterium wasn't in this episode at all.
Yeah.
Neither was Mrs. Coulter. So that's interesting. For
first
sure.
First one without Culty. First one without Culty. Look at her. And look at her.
Like, as again, Azrael is just being talked about all over the place, but not even a hint of him. So,
no.
That was interesting. So, what I question. So, my question is more of a meta question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is one that I think we've talked about. Should we even raise this? Mm-hmm. But I think we have to. So this is probably one of the most diverse television shows I have watched in a very long time. Okay. I love when fantasy stories do this because it is a way that we can imagine society outside of the context of our world. Mm-hmm. That said, we are 5 episodes in. There have been 3 on-screen deaths, and all 3 of those people have been people of color. Yeah. And that is something that other shows have done. Mm-hmm. Notably, like The Walking Dead did that. Mm-hmm. And they got a lot of flack for it. Now, granted, this is an English television show. And, you know, as you know, my mother grew up in England. Mm-hmm. My grandparents lived in England most of my life. Most of my other cousins live in England. So I understand that the racial dynamics are different there. And obviously, The Walking Dead is a show that is about a zombie apocalypse that takes place in Georgia. So mm-hmm. it's like a totally different dynamic. I just think it's worth noting. I'm not mad about it. I think that these are not gratuitous deaths. Every single one of the deaths has moved the story along or revealed something we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. When Adele died, it showed us that when a demon is killed, so is the person. When Benjamin died, he was demonstrating for us this oath that Tony took at the beginning of the season in episode 1, but he also was demonstrating what Father Corum was saying, which is basically like, we're ride or die for our mm-hmm. mission. We are mm-hmm. going to see this mission through no matter what it cost us. We are duty bound mm-hmm. to do this. And then Billy's death obviously is the most impactful because Billy is a character we've been worried about since the last scene in the first episode when he was captured. But also he is showing what happens to the children and what happens when you cut a demon away. So I just think that it's something that I wish that the writers had thought more about, because I do think that if people aren't mindful of things like this, that killing characters of color first and often can send a certain type of message that is, you know, it's unconscious bias. I don't think that this is like they're trying to do this intentionally, and there are ways they could do it intentionally that would be part of the story and mm-hmm. would have more meaning. I think they should be careful of this.
I agree.
And so agree. That's one of my questions. As soon as Billy died, this popped into my head right away. And I don't mm-hmm. think I'm the only person. So I want to acknowledge the people who are also concerned about this. I think that they should have been more mindful. That said, I'm not mad about it. I'm yeah. happy that the cast is very diverse. And when you have a diverse cast, of course, like the characters of color are going to die as well. Like that's part of being part of these stories. Mm-hmm. But I just think that the way it's been done one after the other, it's a little bit much.
Yeah.
What I'm looking forward to, I need to know more about this process of intercision. What is, what exactly, because Billy was more mutilated, I'll just use that word, than I expected. The way that, I mean, they shaved his head. I mean, Billy had this head of curls, and I need to understand the process, because I had always thought of it like is, I don't know. I just didn't think of it as torture in the same way. Like, yes, it is, what they're doing is horrible, and the removal of someone's demon is torture, but there was also physical torture here, and it was really upsetting. And so I would like to understand better what happened, and also how Billy came to be alone in that village, why he was just left behind. So that's something that I'm looking forward to learning more about. And what I liked about this episode was essentially everything with Will and his mom. I thought that the introduction of Will and this, I complained to you that I thought this episode's editing was clunky, and I still stand by that, because I think it was tough to go back and forth between worlds so often. In previous episodes, when we've gone back and forth between the worlds, it's been like one or two scenes with Boreal. There was a lot of cutting back and forth, and it kind of interrupted the action in the camp. Like, a lot of stuff was happening in the Egyptian camp, and then a conversation would end and we would go straight to Elaine and Will.
Yeah.
I didn't like the way that it was edited. That said, I liked all of the, I liked for the most part all of the scenes that were about Elaine and Will. I think we learned so much about Will so quickly. And also, Elaine just, she laid out a lot of what she's known, she knows about what Grumman was doing as well, and that there are more, she's a person in our world who understands that there are other worlds, even though I don't think she quite understands the full context, but she saying this world is broken, she clearly knows more than she's letting on.
Yep.
And so I liked that introduction as well, and I also just liked how they showed how difficult it is for kids who have mental illness in their family, and how, in addition to dealing with, you know, his mom's problems, and when she's having a bad day, Will also has to deal with that. No one the isolation, nobody understands what he's going through. And the people who are aware, except for the coach, make fun of him.
Yeah.
They're cruel about it. So I really liked all the stuff with Will and his mom.
I did too. I really loved it too. I thought everything, I love all your points. I think every last one of your points I resonate with. I definitely felt like, you know, on the thing that we're talking about the diverse cast as well, I think like it's really important to note that Will and his mom are people of color. Like it hasn't actually, you know, like that's not the way that it reads in the books, and it's not the way that, you know, even listening to the audiobooks too, it's not cast, that doesn't seem to be cast that way. And so it's really cool to see that. And it's also was like, you know, I felt like it was difficult for the show to balance, you know, the introduction of Boreal with something and the going back and forth between the two worlds. And I think that's what you're speaking about the editing. And I think it's going to get better over time in the fact that they waited five episodes to truly introduce why this other world was really important. You know what I mean? Like, and so we went five episodes where, you know, in some other shows that we love, you know, I keep referencing Thrones because it's one that we talk about quite a bit. You know, you knew where the Wall was. You knew where, you know, Winterfell was. You knew where King's Landing was. You knew all the key. You knew a lot of the key places within one to two episodes. And one of the things that became super hard for that show, if you remember, was the introduction of Dorne. And I think it's similar. There's not as bad as that here, but like they're introducing a lot of complex things about the story in the fifth episode versus if they were going to make this choice to tell the stories parallel earlier on in the series, you know?
Yeah. So. I mean, anytime you split up your main characters and have them in different places, you're going to struggle with this. This is hard to do in storytelling. Mm-hmm. I found this really difficult in Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. Season 3, where our groups that had been one or two groups before seemed to be on three different missions.
Yeah.
All throughout the third season. Wait, that was the third season, right? Yeah. Third season of Stranger Things. I struggled with the way that story was told. Some of the episodes, if they spent too long with a group I didn't particularly care about, I got a little bit disengaged. It all came together in the end, and I think that will happen here. But I just thought this it was rough going. And so because I was like, why are we going back to Will and Elaine now? Why like there were some scenes that just seemed like they could have flowed more seamlessly if they had told the story differently. But then the flip side of that is like, maybe not having Lyra on screen for 30 minutes of the episode while we're being introduced to Will. And that's not great either. I'm not a filmmaker. So this is more of a, from a viewer's point of view, I struggled with this, but it's not, bad. This is still I'm surprised every episode at how well the story is unfolding and how exciting they've made a lot of parts of it. So I'm enjoying it, but I just, those were, some of my criticisms, of the product, really just the production. But I think a lot of stuff is done so well. I mean, come on, like Yorick looked amazing in this episode again.
Oh my gosh. Again, he looks great. He looks great. I mean, like everything, I can't even believe how good this bear looks. It's so good.
And everything in the north was so beautiful. Like every time we arrived back at the Egyptian camp, I was just like, this is gorgeous. And also hats off to the Egyptians. They build a pretty good camp.
They do. It felt cozy. It looked cozy.
They know how to set up a shop. They're good at this.
Not good at watching it. Very good at setting it up. Very good.
Fair point. Fair point.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, but we appreciate all of you listening. I'm loving this show. I'm pretty sad we only have 3 episodes left in the season. I'm really looking forward to how they land it. Again, please go and leave reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps the show. And don't forget that you can leave us commentary through email at kinfolklore@gmail.com.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. We will see you next week.